All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're taking a closer look at a pretty crucial part of the Fourth Amendment in action, you know, where the theory hits the streets. So we're going to dissect a 2017 case from the First Circuit. It's called United States v. Bellin, and it's all about how courts actually apply these like fundamental protections against unreasonable searches and seizures, you know, like out there in the real world.
So really putting these constitutional rights to the test.
Exactly. And for all of you law students out there, and you know, especially those of you who are just diving into constitutional law, this case is a perfect example of how this reasonable suspicion standard that we always hear about, how that actually works, you know, in practice.
It's one thing to study the landmark cases like Terry v. Ohio, which really lay the groundwork for stop and frisks. But Bellin takes this a step further, showing us how those principles are actually applied by judges today.
Like we all learn about Terry v. Ohio, but how often do we get to see those principles play out in a modern case like Bellin?
So in this deep dive, we're going to break down the key facts of the case, and we'll walk through the court's reasoning behind their decision. And by the end of this, hopefully you'll have a much clearer understanding of what constitutes a lawful stop and frisk. You know, what are those key elements, and what does all this mean for our Fourth Amendment rights? So let's dive right in.
Okay, sounds good.
To set the stage, can you kind of walk us through the events that led up to Bellin's encounter with the police? Like, what happened?
So it all started when police officers got reports of a fight near a public park. And this wasn't just any park. It was known for having, you know, a bit of a reputation, a history of firearm-related incidents. So that detail becomes really important later on in the court's decision.
Oh, interesting.
So as the officers arrived at the scene, they saw William Bellin walking away from a group of men.
Okay, so far, pretty normal.
On the surface, maybe. But a couple of things made this stand out to the officers.
Well, first of all, the officer who ended up stopping Bosan, he actually knew Bolin from before. He knew that Balin had a prior arrest, a firearms offense.
Okay, so there was already some history there.
And on top of that, this officer also knew from a police database that Balin was associated with a gang. But it wasn't just Balin's past that caught their attention. It was also how he acted when the police showed up. So not only did he separate himself from the group, but he also started walking away pretty quickly, you know, like he was trying to avoid
All
them.
right, trying to get out of there.
And then when the officers started questioning him, they noticed what they described as unusual nervousness.
Now, that word unusual, that seems important. What made his nervousness different from, you know, the typical nerve someone might have when they're being questioned by the police?
That's a great question. And that distinction was really important to the court. In their decision, they described Bellin's nervousness as a strong reaction to being questioned. They pointed out things like he kept changing his facial expressions, you know, his whole demeanor was shifting. He was taking these really deep breaths, and he was like constantly looking around, you know, almost as if he was searching for a way to escape the situation.
So it wasn't just a little bit of fidgeting.
No, it was more than that. It was a whole bunch of behaviors that together suggested he was super anxious, specifically because of the police.
Okay, I got it. So after this interaction, what happened?
So after observing all of this, the officers decided to frisk Bellin, and that's when they found a handgun, marijuana, and ammunition.
So those are the key facts that went before the court. What was the main legal argument that Bellin's defense team made?
Basically, they argued that the whole thing, the stop and the frisk, violated Bellin's Fourth Amendment rights. They said the police didn't have a good enough reason, a legal justification to stop him in the first place, which meant that any evidence they found afterwards shouldn't be allowed in court.
I see. So they're saying the stop was illegal and therefore the evidence they found is tainted.
But there was another interesting twist in this case. Bellin also tried to stop his own lawyer from using certain arguments in his defense.
Wait, really? Like he was trying to limit his own defense. What did he not want his lawyer to argue?
Yeah, it's pretty unusual. He didn't want his lawyer to claim that the gun was planted on him or that he didn't know he had it.
Interesting. So how did the courts ultimately rule on these two issues?
So both the district court in Maine, where the case was first heard, and the First Circuit Court of Appeals, which reviewed the lower court's decision, both sided with the government. They upheld Bellin's conviction.
Okay, so let's break down that first issue, the legality of the stop and frisk. It all comes down to this idea of reasonable suspicion. Now, for our listeners, especially those who are still learning about the law, can you explain what that means in the context of this case and how it connects back to Terry v. Ohio?
Absolutely. So Terry v. Ohio was a landmark case that essentially said, hey, police can stop someone for a brief investigation even if they don't have enough evidence for a full-blown arrest.
Right.
But there's a catch. They need what's called reasonable suspicion.
Okay.
That means the officer needs to have specific, articulable facts that would lead a reasonable person to believe that criminal activity is happening.
So it has to be more than just a gut feeling.
Right. It can't be a hunch. It has to be based on something concrete. Mm-hmm. Now, Terry also said that if an officer has lawfully stopped someone and they have a reasonable suspicion to believe that person is armed and dangerous, they can frisk them, which is basically a pat down of their outer clothing.
To make sure they're not carrying a weapon.
Exactly, for officer safety. So in Bellin, the question was whether the officers had this reasonable suspicion based on the specific circumstances of their encounter with Bellin.
Got it. And the courts said yes.
Yes, they did. And they emphasized that they were looking at the totality of the circumstances, meaning they weren't just focusing on one thing in isolation. It was about the whole picture.
So what were the specific things that the First Circuit pointed to when they said there was reasonable suspicion?
Well, they gave a lot of weight to Bellin's past, specifically his prior firearm conviction and his gang affiliation.
So that history played a role.
Absolutely. Then there was the location. The fact that this park was known for firearm incidents, that added to the overall sense of risk in that situation.
So the location itself contributed to the reasonable suspicion.
Yeah, it added to the context. And then there was Bellin's behavior, you know, separating from the group, walking away quickly. Those actions suggested he was trying to avoid the police, which can be a red flag.
Right. It makes sense.
And of course, we can't forget about that unusual nervousness. The court really focused on how Bellin's reaction was more than just typical nerves. They pointed to all those specific behaviors. His shifting demeanor, the deep breaths, the way he was scanning the area.
It was more pronounced, more intense.
Right. And remember, this intense nervousness happened right when the officer asked Bellin if he was carrying anything.
Ah, so that connection was important.
Yes. It suggested that his anxiety was directly related to the possibility of being caught with a weapon, especially given his history and the location.
Okay, so the court essentially said, he's got a history of firearm offenses. He's in a known high crime area for firearms. He's trying to avoid the police, and he's acting super nervous, especially when asked about carrying something. Put all that together, and it's reasonable for an officer to suspect that he might be carrying a gun illegally.
Exactly. The court basically said, given all of these factors, a reasonable officer could have believed that criminal activity was going on, specifically unlawful possession of a firearm, and the Bellin might be armed and dangerous. So the stop and frisk were justified for the officer's safety.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, what about the second legal issue, the one where Bellin tried to control his own defense strategy? What did the court say about that?
Well, on that issue, the court was very clear. Bellin had the right to direct his own defense, even if it seemed like a bad idea. They said a criminal defendant has a lot of autonomy when it comes to making decisions about how their case is presented in court.
So even if his lawyer thought that arguing the gun was planted might have been a better strategy, Bellin could still say no.
Exactly. He had the final say. The court recognized that there can be tension between what a defendant wants and what their lawyer thinks is best, but they ultimately said that the defendant gets to make the call on those big strategic decisions.
That's a really fascinating aspect of this case. It highlights the sometimes complex relationship between a lawyer and their client. So, zooming out a bit, what are the big takeaways from the Bellin case? Like, what should law students, future lawyers, really remember about this case?
There are a few key things. First, Bellin gives us a real-world example of how courts use this totality of the circumstances approach when they're deciding if there was reasonable suspicion. It wasn't just one fact that justified the stop and frisk. It was the combination of all the factors.
It was the whole picture.
Right. Second, Bellin shows that unusual nervousness, even though it can be subjective, can actually be an important factor in establishing reasonable suspicion, especially when you have other, more objective factors pointing toward criminal activity, like in this case, potential firearm possession.
It's about connecting that nervousness to other concrete evidence.
Exactly. And another big takeaway from Bellin is that it really shows the constant balancing act that our legal system has to do between protecting public safety and making sure individual rights are respected, particularly in high crime areas.
It's that tension between keeping people safe and respecting individual liberties.
Exactly.
Right.
And even though it's a separate issue, The case also reminds us that a defendant has the right to control their own defense, even if their choices might not seem like the best legal strategy.
Right, they have the right to make those decisions. So it sounds like United States v. Berlin is a really important case for understanding how the Fourth Amendment plays out in real life, especially when it comes to stop and frisks.
It definitely is. It takes those principles from Terry and shows us how they're applied in a modern situation.
It shows the nuances, the complexities.
Exactly.
So to wrap up our deep dive into United States v. Berlin, I think it's safe to say that this case provides some really valuable insight into how the Fourth Amendment, and specifically this idea of a reasonable suspicion, actually works on the ground.
Definitely. It shows that reasonable suspicion isn't a simple checklist. It's a deeper analysis that considers all the facts together.
And it leaves us with a question to think about. When unusual nervousness is part of the equation, how do we make sure that it's being weighed fairly alongside other evidence? How do we prevent bias and protect against abuse? It's an important question, especially as we continue to grapple with the balance between individual rights and law enforcement.
Absolutely. It's a conversation that we need to keep having.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll see you next time.
See you then.